let me confess at the outset that I didn't have any such profound reason in choosing meditation for our theme this evening. I did it for self-preservation, because almost every day when I meet friends, people, they ask me how to meditate, what is to be done during meditation, and what is meditation. So each one of them, I tell them, we'll be having a talk which you might attend. Otherwise I would have to repeat what I'm going to say at least 10 times a day. So we are here. Meditation is very much in a fashion, very much in the news, and you know there are meditations and meditations. There are meditations to relax. Relax so that you can be more efficient in your offices. Meditations to get more in tune with nature, whatever it may mean. Meditations to make scientific discoveries, and meditations to realize God, to achieve something of a divine consciousness, to enter into deeper or higher realm of divine existence. I limit myself to the last category of meditation. Meditation is a means, is a gateway opening from normal, limited human existence to a higher, broader, and a vaster diviner existence. And such a technique of meditation, you will admit, needs a special background. We have to have a special climate where this type of meditation can be practiced with any hope of success. During my last visit to the States, everywhere I was confronted, people claiming to do meditation, putting their difficulties, why they don't see any beginnings of a new consciousness, new age. And when I inquired of their background, their goals, they were frank enough to say that no conditions were imposed upon them. They were told, you don't have to change anything in life. You have all the things that you are accustomed to. Drink, sex, food, all that you have, you don't have to make any change in your routine. All that you have to do is for a certain minutes in the morning and in the evening, you sit and repeat the particular mantra that is communicated to you, and you will go to the source of thought. Well, this type of meditation is a technique to withdraw from the surface hectic movement of the mind. Nothing more. It is only a window opening on certain possibilities. But thereafter, it is presumed that a lot of homework has to be done, a lot of follow-up work has to be done, but nobody does it. Similarly, there are other panaceas offered to the modern mind in order to get accepted, that you don't have to have any inhibitions, any kind of conditions. All these man-made, mind-made restrictions only inhibit you, limit you, they prevent you from attuning yourself with nature. So they say, when you get angry, just get angry. When you want to hit, hit. Don't impose any restriction on yourself. These are all regressive disciplines which man should overpass. What happens when we follow this facile prescription of conduct is that we go back in our scale of evolution. Instead of passing beyond the human stage into something godly, you slide back into animal stage and disserve yourself and the purpose of life. Let me say at once that the meditation of which I speak, meditation as a part of yoga which can transform your life, which can build one more step in your inner evolution, requires certain conditions to be fulfilled. Only when you fulfill those conditions can you think of having a real practice of meditation. And these conditions have been there, systematized, made part of a psychological discipline by that great master of yoga known as Patanjali thousands of years ago. And he begins saying that before you can practice any type of meditation, yoga, you must pattern your life in the mold of certain injunctions and observances. He gives first a set of five negative conditions, followed by five positive conditions. These are to be woven into the texture of your life, made part of it, so that whatever practice of yoga or meditation you follow, it becomes meaningful, it becomes productive. And the first condition, he says, is ahimsa, non-violence. Non-violence, not in the sense of an external non-violence. Sri Aurobindo observes somewhere, even if you desist from physical violence, there is what is called a soul violence, which can be 1,000 times more destructive than physical violence. If, for instance, you coerce, you exert a pressure, compulsion on others to come to your point of view by undergoing a fast, for instance, well, you are releasing certain vibrations which are infinitely more harmful than physical compulsion. Elimination of all thought of violence, harm from the mind, from the emotions, not to speak of actions. This wholesale elimination of violence from your being is the very first condition. There is an old tradition which is still exemplified and seen to be true in our lives, that in the presence of a person who has weeded out violence from his being, animals, creatures of instinctive hostility, they forget their hostility and they lie close together. There are scores of instances in Sanskrit literature where it is described how the lion and the lamb, the serpent and the mongoose lie in the shades of a hermitage where the rishi does his tapas. They are not just legendary accounts, but even today, in places where holy men live, who have really achieved this harmlessness in their consciousness, this is seen to be true. People, even men, who in these matters are worse than animal creatures, they forget their violence, their enmity, and for the moment at least, they breathe a purer air. This is the first condition, elimination of violence from our being. Second is truth, truthfulness. Now, truthfulness is not just telling what is true. It means a regulation of conduct by which there is a consistency between our thought, our feeling, our speech. Nothing shall be expressed through our speech which is not true, which does not represent what we think. It is possible one may really believe something to be true and say that is matter. But to know a thing is not true and give expression to it, that is one of the most unspiritual acts. I remember there were cases when mother used to say that from a spiritual point of view, an utterance of a falsehood is more harmful than a sexual lapse. She attached that importance that you must nothing express. You must express nothing. This is not true. I don't recollect the exact words of a memorable sentence of her. She said, how can you expect to be a true servant to the divine, an instrument to the divine, if you allow even the slightest element of falsehood to be expressed, to escape your mouth? And that is also a tradition, a very priceless tradition. In India, that if you make it a point to speak nothing but the truth, after a time, you have what is called vak siddhi, perfection in speech, by which whatever you say comes true. Our history is replete with instances. Why? Because they have said something, it had to come true. They have felt sorry for having said it, but they could not help its getting actualized in life. This is the power of speech. It has to be conserved, guarded, and utilized in the best way. That is why in spiritual life they recommend economy of speech. When there is economy of speech, there is control. You know what you are going to speak. This is the principle behind the old rule of silence. Silence in speech, maunam. Indeed, maunam really means a maunam of the mind inside, not maunam just of speech. If the lips are closed but the mind is seething, it's no silence. But it's economy of speech, to speak the minimum. But when you speak, you have to speak effectively, just what you want to say. As a discipline, if we do that for a while, it becomes a permanent habit and an acquisition. So we have dealt with harmlessness, truthfulness in consciousness. Third is what is called aparigraha, non-stealth. It does not mean naturally, not stealing of things. Nobody would steal in the society. But a mental stealing, casting a glance upon what belongs to somebody else, appropriating it mentally, whether you physically do it or not, Now, this kind of extension of one's own consciousness to claim something that belongs, cast a greed, that is an unspiritual failing. Fourth is non-acceptance of gifts. Now, non-acceptance of gifts, there is a great psychology behind it. It is not that we don't accept gifts, but gifts, loaded gifts, gifts which are given with a certain calculation. Now, this is called, when you accept a gift, you accept what is behind it. You accept a claim of the others. You lay yourself under obligation of those. If the gifts are spontaneous, if they are given on a spur of emotion, love, goodwill, well, it is an offense to reject it. One has to respond in the same spirit. But where they are given with a purpose, it is best not to get under obligation, because the intention in giving is to get that person obligated. All these, then the fifth one is what is called brahmacharya. Now, a lot of havoc has been caused by a misunderstanding of what exactly this word means. Now, literally, brahmacharya means, charya is conduct, way of life. Brahma is the reality, a way of life leading towards Brahma, whatever that may mean. It does not mean a hard and fast rule of absolute continence. There are categories of people. At the stage of student world, one would say, yes, absolute continence. But that would not be the interpretation in the case of householders, much less in the case of vanaprasthas or recluses. It depends upon the stage of life in the society in which one lives. However, it is meant that the principle is conservation of sex energy, whether in the male body or in the female body, leads to a certain increase in effectivity. Sri Aurobindo describes in one of his small seminal works how sex energy in a person, if it is compared to water, it is a primary formulation of energy in a human body. Now, if it is compared to water, normally the tendency of nature is at a certain stage to utilize it for its own purpose of propagation of species. But if one wants to exceed nature, he wants to go beyond nature, then one conserves. One does not allow it. You want water? Sure. If it is not allowed to be thrown out, expended, well, it gathers heat. One feels a certain heat in the system. And with that heat, there is an increase in the effectivity of one's dynamic energy. Tapas, heat. It makes it more effective. Whatever you want to do, the willpower gets strengthened. Effectivity of your will gets more powerful. If you conserve it still further, the heat turns into light, tejas, and the brain gets illumined. The brain power gets sharpened and enlightens everything in an extraordinary way. If you persist still, both the heat and the light turn themselves into electricity, vidyut, as a result of which there is both a mental brilliance, illumination, as also a dynamic effectivity. Still further, Vidyut turns into what is called Ojas. It is that primal state of ether, primal ether, from where all this creation has come to be. So one arrives at a stage where one gets creative power. Still further, it converts itself into virya, a spiritual power capable of landing you in spiritual realization of the self. Now these are the various gradations of the self-sublimation of sexual energies. Now each one has to decide according to the person's conditions, readiness, up to what the person can go. There is no hard and absolute rule in these matters. All that is to be taken care is that one's consciousness must not be clouded with sex. Mental sex is more harmful than physical sex. The mental sex creates certain grooves in the mind, in the subliminal, everywhere in the system, by which even when you are not indulging in mental sex, certain vibrations go on responding. This is the principle to be kept in mind. Mother experimented in various ways, in various forms, and the last word that she said somewhere a few years before she passed was that sex is not, abstention from sex is not something to be imposed on a person. If it is imposed, it becomes untrue. One must feel from within the irrelevance of sex. When one arrives at that stage of evolution, one feels it pointless. It just drops off and one feels tainted, impure. It is that stage when one is really free from sex. Mother used to always say that in India, they make too much of sex. Negatively, if in the West they do too much of it in certain parts positively, we here do it negatively. Let us have a healthy attitude. It is something of nature. It is a vestige of the animal past. It is not going to have a future in the new age of spiritual consciousness. Mother was very definite about it, that it will not continue to play a part in future evolution of man. What method nature is going to devise for the continuation of the species is still a secret. We have completed the first five negative conditions, and then we come to the positive five, what are called niyamas. First is cleanliness. Now this cleanliness again is not an outer cleanliness. Taking bath 10 times doesn't make one clean. It is an inner cleanliness. In one of the ancient Upanishads, there is an important passage where he said, Ahara Shuddha Sattva Shuddhi. In the purity of food lies the purity of consciousness. In the purity of consciousness lies remembrance. When there is remembrance, there is a release from the knots of ignorance. Commenting upon this, no less a person than Acharya Shankara, he says, here food, ahara, does not mean kitchen food. It is what is brought near. The thoughts that we think, the feelings that we have, That is the real food. It is not just physical food. And there one has to have purity. One has to purify one's psychological food, the emotional food, and that is true purity. Indeed, physical purity has to be there, but it is a very elementary stage. Next is contentment. Contentment with what you have got. Not that fevered excitement, wanting to get what others have, what I don't have. A seeker must accept that the conditions in which he is placed are intended for him. Mother said on more than one occasion that for a spiritual seeker, the conditions in which he are just the ones that would help his evolution most. Even if they appear to be otherwise, once he has that attitude, they do turn out to be so. So this acceptance of what you have, what they call coming to terms with life, my energies, my effort has to be in a different direction. Not to get all these things which other people have. Let me learn to live what I have got. My effort, my energies must go in a different direction. So contentment, santosha, is the second. Third is study, swadhyaya. One has to study. It is only by reading, study, a purposeful study, that grooves are formed in our consciousness to receive the higher thought. That is another advantage, and that is, in study, you keep the company of the great ones who have written. It is not possible for all of us to have the company of the great always whenever we choose. As Sri Aurobindo observes humorously, somewhere, the great ones do not always come to our doors, nor do we know where their doors are. So, we have the blessings of God, in that there is a vast literature, mystical literature, spiritual literature, recording, communicating the experience of a divine consciousness that they had. Each word, Mother says somewhere, is a battery, each word of such writings is a battery of those vibrations. When you take them, when you read, you automatically keep company with those ones, share their consciousness, allow them to grow in you. That is why they insist upon study. Some part of the day, one must keep aside. We never miss a paper, however busy we are. We never miss the daily newspaper. But do we take the same precaution? Do we have the same preference, say for the Gita, the Upanishads, or any spiritual writing like the Synthesis of Yoga or the Life Divine, essays in the Gita? We say we have no time. Well, that is the thing that should not be done. If so much of our time and energy is set apart for providing ourselves with physical food, some part of it can certainly be kept for providing ourselves with spiritual food. If we can make it a point to spend even 15 to 20 minutes of the day in a concentrated study, well, you will find after some time that it provides a certain sustenance for the program of the whole day. And it goes on working. Mother used to say that a book like Life Divine, whether you understand it or not, when you read, she says, new cells are formed. The very fact that you read, you are exposed to those vibrations. And there are new grooves, and new cells are formed. So after a time, you suddenly begin to understand Why you understand? Because new cells are formed. So swadhyaya, study, and then tapas. Tapas means not austerity in the sense of imposing hardships on us, standing in the sun or always dipping yourself in water, sitting near the fire, fasting, denying yourself food and all that. It's not that. Tapas means concentration of energies for any purpose. Normally, where all our consciousness faculties, energies are spread in 100 directions. They are to be drawn together and conserved. The area of their spread out has to be narrowed. This is called tapas. Incubation of energy. Conservation and incubation of energies. And then Ishvara Pranidhana, that is surrender to God. Realization that with all these, the best that human effort can do is but little. The challenge is so big. The call is so deep. The problem is so vast that human intelligence, human will can't meet the situation by itself. So one links oneself to a higher power, to a higher will, and that is by surrender to God. One links one's will to the divine will by surrender. Now surrender is easier said than done. Surrender is a process. One never achieves it in a day or in a month or in a year. It requires considerable time of part of lifetime to work out surrender in day-to-day activities, to centrally decide either in the heart or in the mind that I am going to surrender, that I surrender to the divine, is the starting point. Thereafter, in the measure of your sincerity, you translate that determination into practice. And this detailed working of surrender into practice is what is called consecration. A sacred translation of the will to surrender in life. When all these things are systematically, simultaneously worked out into your life, you are ready to enter spiritual life, to practice meaningful meditation. It is not that one has to wait for all 1, 2, 3, 4, 10 things to be done. But one starts, all these things are to be simultaneously started. And they are not things that are going to be completed in a day or two. They take time. But one has to have that sense of movement, sense of participation in this program, individual program. There is a facile belief among my fellow sadhaks following the yoga of integral perfection that we don't need the yamas and niyamas. It is 100% wrong belief. Sri Aurobindo and mother took it for granted that before a person turns to such a serious quest, one has equipped oneself with these qualifications. In one of the chapters in the synthesis of yoga, Sri Aurobindo emphasizes, makes it clear that a minimum moral and psychological purification is indispensable before one can really proceed in this yoga. It is this he means, that one has observed these precautions, imbibed these disciplines. Now after that comes the question of asana. When you are mentally ready, psychologically prepared, emotionally tranquil, afire with a certain thirst for a divine peace, divine seeking, first is the asana. What posture you are going to take? Our body is normally so restless. I cannot normally sit in a place for more than 5 minutes without shaking either my legs or my fingers. And this restlessness in the body distracts the attention. One has to learn to sit in one place, immobile, without movement. And for that, there is a whole science. We need not go into those complicated postures. But there are certain postures which promote a feeling of stolidity, stability in the body, where you forget the body. The true test of an asana is that you forget the body. You just think of what you want to think without being pulled either by a pain in the joint here or a stretching somewhere. And an asana can be that which, as Patanjali says, in which you feel the most at ease. What is an asana for me may not be an asana for you. Sri Aurobindo used to observe humorously that his asana was walking. He used to walk, you know, daily 7 to 10 miles where he lived. And before the ashram formed, what was called the guest house where he stayed, the floor on which he walked every day, it had made a regular furrow from one end to the other. So when he left, some foolish people went and put cement. It would never have been done in any other country. And they closed it up, but the marks are there still. Even when he had accident and he had fractured his leg in 1938, afterwards, when he was in a position to walk, he did walk for 7 miles per day. In the beginning, he would hold Champaklal and walk. Afterwards, he took a stick. Afterwards, he would leave the stick, but he would walk 7 miles. It was to be counted how many hours. And that was because he was accustomed to it. And he would meditate only during that time. So some of us have our own idiosyncrasies, our own ways. At times, standing is a most favorable condition to receive, to think, to meditate. But normally, for most of us, the position recommended is to sit erect. It may be on a chair, it may be on a floor, whether it is Padmasana or Sukhasana or Siddhasana, it is a different matter. Each one has to experiment and find out where he can sit for the longest time, forgetting the body. What is important is that the spine should be erect, the back, the neck and the head should be in a straight line. Srirunnatam. And when this posture is achieved, you are erect, so that there is no obstruction to the flow of the current of life, whether the current comes from below or a higher current from above. There should be no physical deflection, obstruction. That care should be taken, and that is done when you have an erect position. This is extremely important in meditation, to have an erect posture. Whether you stand and meditate, sit and meditate, but never sleep and meditate. It is only a self-deception. People think that they say, I meditate in sleeping. No, it is just sink into inertia, in conscience, and it does not. And second thing is, never to rest the head, either here or on anything else. The head must be held alone, erect. These are the normal elementary precautions, which one presumes do not need to be said, but after lots of 30 or 40 years of observation and experience, it does look that these things have to be mentioned. The next step is breathing. Most of us are blissfully unaware of how we are breathing. We are not aware that many times we are breathing through only one nostril. God has given us two nostrils, but no, we breathe in one. We up to here only we breathe. We rarely breathe up to our full lungs. This is a very wrong practice, which has been a thing which has been totally neglected in our upbringing. Apart from other advantages, health giving, life increasing, of this attention to the breathing, we are concerned with that aspect of breathing which promotes meditation. Taking that limited view, you must note that breathing is intimately connected with the thought activity of the mind. Normally, everyone complains that the mind is restless, there are too many thoughts. Well, the only way to arrest this flow of thoughts, to regulate the flow of thoughts, to establish and introduce some sort of order in the mind is to regulate the breathing. To breathe as slowly as possible. Observe one's breath, make it as slow, establish a certain rhythm between in-breathing and out-breathing. Immediately we will observe the mind gets slowed down. Similarly, when you find the mind agitated, you will find that your breathing is very irregular. When the breathing is regular, the mind is also regulated. The whole science of pranayama has been built, but that's not our subject today. What is necessary is to utilize the technique of rhythmic breathing to get and acquire a control over the mind. There are techniques in which one follows the breath deeper and deeper, as into a well. There is an old Vedic image, and enters into the depths of one's consciousness, but that's another matter also. Now, regulation of breathing, finding one's proper posture, regulation of breathing. And third comes the focusing of our mind. As I said, normally our mental faculties are spread in 1,000 directions like so many threads. If at any moment I'm stopped and asked, what were you thinking? Mostly, I won't be able to say, because everything is going on unconsciously. I'm walking in one place, looking at one place, thinking another thing, and nobody knows what it is. So this, a little time to gather all the outspread mental energies, that is called pratyaha, bringing back from where they are spread out the mental faculties. Once you bring them close, thereafter, you can't just bring them and keep them. In the very nature of things, they demand something on which they are to be fixed. So that is where you call concentration. That is, you choose something on which all these things are focused. All your thoughts, faculties, emotions, they are focused. Now what is that thing going to be? It varies from person to person, from system to system, from need to need. It can be a form that represents God to you, a form of beauty, or a sound which has certain pleasant associations, what they call mantras, or a movement, a feeling of a presence, a flame, true flame or an imaginary flame, a true flower or an imaginary flower, whatever it is, or even an idea, a thought. The divine as love, the divine as consciousness, as power, whatever it is. So you have either a form or a thought, an idea or a sound, on which you focus your attention. This is called dharana or mind. I'm sorry, concentration. In the very nature of things, this concentration cannot last for more than a few minutes. It becomes highly unnatural should you try to prolong it beyond a certain limit. It imposes a strain, and meditation is anything but a strenuous process. It has to be a natural and a spontaneous process. So this concentrated attention on a thing, fixed, it is just allowed to relax. Relaxed in this sense that the consciousness, the mind is allowed to flow on that idea, on that form, on that sound. It does not stay fixed in one spot, but it goes on developing thought after thought, but concerned with that. It develops the theme. If you think of God as love, in what way God manifests as love? What experience of love? All these you go on developing, and that is called meditation. Meditation is the flow of consciousness, an unrolling of the mind and consciousness on any theme, on any form, on any sound representing the divine. And this goes on, excluding other themes. The important point is, even though the mental faculties and consciousness is released to flow, like oil from a wick is the classical simile. There is a continuous, uninterrupted flow of oil in the wick. That way your consciousness flows. But it should flow without being interrupted by other distractions, so that it gets absorbed, and as things develop, as the discipline gathers strength, by continuous practice, regularity in practice. If you have an hour, you should have an hour or half an hour, whatever it is, at a fixed time. To that I'll come a little later. The consciousness gets absorbed gradually with the object of meditation, and once it gets absorbed in it, the difference between the meditator and what is meditated upon, it gets less and less, and one becomes one with that object. This becoming one with the object is called the beginnings of samadhi, a trance condition. There are 7 or 8 varieties of samadhi, into which again we need not enter, because it is doesn't concern our immediate question, subject. You will ask, when you start meditating, easy enough, but there are thoughts, there are distractions. At least 1,000 people must have asked. The moment we sit, we get invasions of thoughts. They are not there when we are normally busy doing work. But the moment we sit for meditation, there is this rush of thoughts. How to stop? Now, it is not true that the thoughts are not normally there. They are there always. There is a universal thought current about us, but we are not cognizant of it. We are not acutely aware of it, because we are absorbed in many other things. When we withdraw our attention from the customary preoccupations, we become aware of what is going on. We think they are our thoughts. They are not our thoughts. They are universal thoughts. Thought movements, thought currents, of which we become suddenly aware. What is to be done? Certainly, they are to be stopped. They are not to be allowed to interrupt our practice of meditation. There are 3 or 4 ways. One is to allow the thoughts to come, but oneself to remain without participation. Allow the thoughts, but you just observe, contemplate. This is called the jhana of contemplation, where you just observe what are all the thoughts. They reveal a good deal of yourself, which needs to be tackled. many corners in you which are unlit, and they expose a good deal of your own being. But when you only note but don't participate, the thought movement slowly comes to a stop, and the slowdown and the cease. But one must have a lot of patience. Sincerity in not allowing oneself to participate in the thought movement. Second, very difficult, but when achieved, most effective, is to treat each thought as an intruder and shut it out as it comes. Laboriously, strenuously, shut out each thought as it comes. And this creates what is called a vacant mind, a clean slate on which the divine finger can write what it chooses. A third method is to ignore the thoughts. A method which I have found most practical, and that is, I have something to think about, meditate about. I concern myself with that. If there are so many thoughts coming, distractions, well, let them come and play on the surface. As I am talking and you are listening, we hear so many noises, children there playing, the birds chirping, but it doesn't affect us. Motor horns, plane noises, all that, but we take cognizance, but still they don't affect. Now, that they are to be allowed to run about on the surface without prejudice, without being allowed to interfere with our flow of thought, our flow of meditation. This leads, in course of time, to what may be called a bifurcation of consciousness. A major part of the consciousness centered around the inner quest, and the outermost periphery given to mechanical activity. And when this takes place, a bifurcated consciousness, it becomes very convenient in day-to-day life. You are always centered in a poise, a spiritual poise, in touch with your reality. But the outer nature, outer mind, busies itself with routine, mechanical activity of day-to-day life. So this bifurcation of consciousness is a distinct contribution that the practice of meditation can give to make our lives more effective. Embrace both the spiritual and the material side of life. Now, another point which I had held over is regularity in meditation. Is it necessary to have certain fixed timings for meditation, or one meditates when the mood is on? When Sri Aurobindo was asked this question, whether it is not enough to work for the divine, cultivate devotion, or it is necessary to have a fixed hour for meditation. He said one must have fixed hour. One must train the system, the mind, the heart, the emotions. The whole system has to be trained to receive, so that when a great descent takes place, or when the spirit smiles upon you, you are in a condition to receive. So a regular discipline is necessary. To sit every day for certain part of the time, maybe 10 minutes, maybe 15, maybe half an hour, but never more than an hour. It becomes mechanical. It becomes routine. That has to be done. Maybe a little in the morning and a little in the evening. And the time that is most favorable is when nature is most favorable. And the time when nature is most favorable to this meditative movement, recollection of consciousness, is when the night and the day fuse into each other. That is the dawn, the hour of dawn. Similarly, when the day melts into the night, the dusk. These are moments when the active energies of nature are either going to sleep or still asleep. They are not yet awake. And that is the time when nature cooperates. That is why our ancients called this the Brahma Muhurta, the hour of gods. Maybe it is normally taken to be an hour and a half before sunrise, evenings after the sun sets. People living in cities, they have to create, I suppose, their own hours of God. Because when I mentioned something of this, I think it was in London, they had the sun even at 9 o'clock at night. 9 o'clock at night, the sun was there. I was there in June when I was on my way back. Now what are you going to tell them, what dusk hour? Morning you see the sun at 4 o'clock. So one has to find one's rhythm and adjust those things. But what is important is the regularity. It is a truth, an occult truth of life, that there is a certain cycle, a rhythm in things. When you establish a rhythm, there is always a tendency for those favorable things to wait for you at that time. And Mother said, you are not honoring the understanding by not being punctual. If every day you come for study, say you read, meditate at 7 o'clock in the morning, after some time, something gathers in the atmosphere favorable to your endeavor at precisely at that time. And if you don't honor it, after a few disappointments, it withdraws. So that is the truth or the principle behind regularity in spiritual practices, in practices relating to the development or the culturing of consciousness.